Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm the dude.
These cards are 11.
This is a tasty burger.
Inconceivable!
Just a flesh wound.
All right.
As that richly textured audio logo tells us, it's time for another installment of Cult Filmmakers, featuring Ian Haydn Smith, the author of Cult Filmmakers, 50 Movie Mavericks You Need to Know. Today, we have a double feature. We look at the work of Gordon Parks and Melvin Van Peebles. As Ian notes, both were pioneering black directors who inspired so many future filmmakers like Spike Lee and John Singleton with their impressive talents.
Gordon Parks is one of 20th century photography's greats. I mean, this is a guy who was signed up to the Farm Security Administration in the 1930s. This is the organization that wanted to document the truly damaging impact, not just of the Depression, but also the dust storms that plagued a lot of rural America in the early 1930s. And along with other great photographers such as Walker Evans and the wonderful Dorothea Lange, Gordon Parks went out into this world to document life. But what he focused on was the African-American experience. And give you a very good example of where this balance was in terms of attention. There's a really, really great Dee Reese film that was produced by Netflix a couple of years ago called Mudbound. And it stars Carey Mulligan, amongst other actors. And it's about two families, one white, one black. Both of them are in a pitiful state in post-war period. This is looking at the 40s and the 50s in America. But as bad as the situation for the white farmers was, it was always so much worse for the African-American farmers. And so what you see with the Farm Security Administration photos of the 1930s, it is pitifully bad for the lives of the people that Walker Evans and Dorothea Lange shot. But the African-American population in rural areas in America arguably even had it much, much, much worse. And Gordon Parks' photos, he never loses a sense of humanity. There's a formal beauty to his work. And he really is a truly extraordinary photographer. But it's the emotion and the level of empathy that he brings to his subjects that makes him a true great. And he didn't stop there. I mean, you know, the war came and he captured life in other parts of America. He became a very, very good friend of Muhammad Ali. And there's a really great German publisher called Steidl. You go online, S-T-E-I-D-L. And over the course of the last decade, they've been publishing all of the photographs of Gordon Parks over the course of his career. And there are separate volumes on Muhammad Ali. There's a separate volume on his collaboration with Ralph Ellison, the author of Invisible Man. There's a huge five-volume set of his works. And they just show what an absolute genius of a photographer he was. But then, being a classic Renaissance man, someone who was not happy in one form, he decided to look back on his own life and wrote a novel in 1963 called The Learning Tree, semi-autobiographical account of his life, which then, 6 years later in 1969, he turned into a film. Not just a film, but he was the first African-American to be commissioned by a major Hollywood studio to make a film. It's a really, really major achievement.
Hey, boys! You boys, come here! You boys want to make some money?
What do we got to do?
Simple, ain't nothing to it. You'll be 7 of y'all fighting in the ring for $10 a day. The last two standing keep swinging to the Alvin Falls. The winner gets $4 and the loser gets $1.
What happens to the other five?
The smart boy ain't
you. Yeah, who'll get the rest?
Old Spike is the promoter. Every fight's got to have a promoter. I got to pay for the ring. I got to pay for the winner and loser. I got to pay for everything.
And then 2 years after that, probably the thing that these days he's best known for, he directed Shaft. And that was one of the two films that really launched the blaxploitation genre, as it's now known, which were films that placed front and center black characters, not always positive representations of black characters, but certainly trying, as Oscar Michaud had done many years before, trying to offer a different representation of African-American life.
Well, I thought you might know something I want to know. Seems there have been a lot of low, quiet rumbles going on uptown. Our people have been able to pick up the sounds of it, but no words.
That's because us black folk talk mush mouth, Lieutenant.
I thought we were gonna get to it.
We did, but you want me to pigeon. I just said up yours, baby.
How come a couple of cats from Harlem come downtown this morning looking for John Shaft?
Well, they're soul brothers. They came down so I could teach them to handshake.
Probably today it occasionally looks a little bit creaky as a piece of filmmaking, but I think the reason it has lasted is really Isaac Hayes' score and the theme song. That, I mean, it's just stunning. I would argue that if you're going to look at Gordon Parks as a filmmaker, I think The Learning Tree is definitely worth looking at. He made a film about the blues singer Leadbelly in 1976 called Leadbelly. And I think they're really, really great films. And also, I think to look at Gordon Parks at this moment in time in the 1970s, and particularly in terms of, and I know it's now a problematic genre title, blaxploitation, you've also got to look at Melvin Van Peebles. Again, this is another great Renaissance man of African-American culture. Writer, musician, as Gordon Parks also was. He was the classic flaneur. He would travel here, then, everywhere. He was inspired by the New Wave because he went over and lived in Paris for a while. And it was while he was there that he wrote a play, which then became his first film, The Story of a Three-Day Pass.
Uncle Tom? Yeah, you. You are the captain's new good-colored boy. You are the captain's Uncle Tom, baby.
I'm not the captain's Uncle Tom. Maybe yes, maybe no.
That got the attention of Hollywood, even though he couldn't get Hollywood's attention when he was actually based in Hollywood. He was invited to go over and make a film, which he did in 1970. He made Watermelon Man, which is about a white guy who one day wakes up and realizes he's black.
It's a nightmare. That's what it is, old buddy. Nightmare. Must have been something you eat. That's right, something you ate. Put up your hands. Give me a high school ring. A nightmare. Or too much sun lamp. Boy, what a great sun lamp.
And realizes the inequalities of society through that experience. But it was in 1971 when he directed Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song that he really, really became incredibly well known.
Where's Sweetback? Where is he?
Where is he? Sweetback?
I don't know where's Sweetback.
Where's Sweetback?
Come on, boy!
I don't want to get qualitative between the two, but I think the important, if we're looking at the importance of both films, in popular culture, Shaft is incredibly important. But I think politically, the thing about Sweet Sweetback is that it was an entirely independent film. It wasn't financed by Hollywood. There was no compromise whatsoever. It was about a black man rebelling against racism and against white America in the late 60s, early 70s. And it is really full on. It's incredibly uncompromising. It's got an amazing score, once again, by Earth, Wind & Fire. And I think this is an incredibly potent film. I know there have been some discussions more recently over its sexual politics. That's certainly problematic in the film. But I think as a political statement, it is an incredibly powerful film. And Melvin Van Peebles' son, Mario Van Peebles, who would go on himself to become an actor and also a director, probably most famous with New Jack City in the early 1990s, he would actually make a film in 2003 called Badass, in which he plays his father making Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, which is an incredibly entertaining film and is a great accompaniment to the original.
Yeah, how did filmmakers like Gordon Parks and Melvin Van Peebles, how did they influence contemporary filmmakers like Spike Lee, John Singleton, and Jordan Peele?
I think by being the landmark of being these first filmmakers, and obviously I also include in this book Oscar Michaud, and one must never underestimate the importance of this truly incredible filmmaker from the silent era going into the sound era in the 1930s. But I think what these guys did was, I think it's two things. Number one, artistically, and perhaps mixed up with politically, they set a standard. They said, look, a black director can work at making a film that reaches out to people. That's really important. But I think it was the moment that Hollywood woke up and realised that there was a very, very, or mainstream cinema woke up and realised there was a very large audience, the African-American audience, that they had not been making films for. And what I find really interesting is that you have this era of films by black directors featuring a great group of black actors, a great ensemble of black actors. And then it's sort of going quiet again in the late 70s into the early 80s. And obviously you have actors, comedians like Richard Pryor and Eddie Murphy coming to the fore. But they're working predominantly, not entirely, but predominantly within the strictures of white dominant Hollywood. And it's not until you get She's Gotta Have It, Spike Lee's first film in the mid-1980s, followed by School Days, and then the absolute firestorm, the genius that is Do the Right Thing in 1989, followed shortly afterwards by John Singleton with Boys in the Hood, that you suddenly see a shift. And Spike Lee, perhaps before Black Klansman, I might have included as a cult filmmaker. But I think Spike Lee's always kind of dipped his toes into mainstream cinema with films like Inside Man. But the last few years, he's films like Chirac, which is an extraordinary piece of filmmaking. He's really pushed the boundaries of what he can do. But thankfully, and I'm really happy that he's now back at the centre of attention, making films that people should see, because if they're never always perfect, they are incredibly engrossing and always provocative. And I think that's probably something that's missing too much from cinemas these days, is a sense of provocation, is a sense of being challenged, if not intellectually, then politically, is finding a way to shake us and make us think anew at things. And I think there's a whole group of female horror filmmakers are doing that. I think there are a new generation of filmmakers, upcoming filmmakers, that are doing that. I think Barry Jenkins did that incredibly eloquently with Moonlight. And I think there are directors out there that are doing that. But it's kind of interesting. I think what I love about Oscar Michaud and Gordon Parks and Melvin Van Peebles, very different directors who do not need to be grouped together, but they represent directors who are trying to push for a different kind of filmmaking and a different kind of representation, a very positive representation. And what I think with this book, Cult Filmmakers, if I were to return to it in 15 years' time, I think what I would see is an extraordinarily more diverse group of filmmakers being included. And I've tried as hard as I can in terms of gender and in terms of race to include so many other people. What I think will be really amazing over the course of the next decade or two is that net is going to get wider, and we're going to see so many more interesting directors from so many different backgrounds coming out, working in cult cinema, but hopefully also working at the heart of mainstream cinema.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. Ian Haydon Smith, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Ian Haydon Smith talking about Gordon Parks and Melvin Van Peebles. Ian's the author of Cult Filmmakers, 50 Movie Mavericks You Need to Know. Join us for more Cult Filmmakers in the weeks to come. And find out more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Sean Cosby, Tananarive Due, and Ian Haydon Smith. If you want to hear it again or catch up on past episodes that make long drives and housework more bearable, Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Just search for WPR and Beta. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Take crap off of it. You'll give me some more crap.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
You laid all that jive on me in my office.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
I get $50 an hour, plus expenses.